where she would be painting white paint on the white canvas and then add the softest blue and then paint white over that. So you catch, like, it's almost like shadow below the white. Mm-hmm. And by the end, they were just barely not white. But when you studied them closely, you realize there's a whole universe there of texture. and it was at a glance, it thought, what could be simpler than a white painting?
It wasn't, though.
It wasn't at all. She agonized over them, and they to me they were emotional. They actually were really. It was like they I felt like they taught me about life. Hi.
Hello, Mr. Wintery. Long time no see.
So formal.
I was trying to make it a villain, like a Bond villain.
I did name my company out of an aspiration to sound like a Bond villain, Wintery Global Engineering.
You shouldn't say those things publicly.
I thought it was funny. I was like, it's the perfect cover story. You know, Wintery Global Engineering. I could put a thing that's like a subsidiary of the Hitoshi Manufacturing Concern or whatever it is.
Mr. Sparkle.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. It doesn't matter. Most composers have silly company names that they operate under because you need something on, you know, like for paperwork purposes, you need a company, even though in most cases it's a company of one person. And so it was always like, there's a lot of them, you know, it was like Jawa Incorporated or whatever. And so, yeah, anywho. Wintry Global Engineering, because yes, I am a Bond villain.
Yeah,
so
that's funny.
Go. So yes, my apologies for having to miss one, being away in Bangkok.
Meeting the elephants. You are
hanging out with elephants.
Yeah, you're not excused. I'm so jealous. I'm not going to forgive you for this.
They were so sweet, and they were like giant cats almost.
Oh my God.
You know, like
scared of the water.
Yeah, and like a little shy and a little like you know, they weren't like dogs that come running up and are super playful. They kind of let their own devices, you know. But they had really distinct personalities. I never was around them. I've seen them from at the zoo, obviously, where you kind of look at the across the fence or whatever and you see them, But to be able to like walk with them and pet them and they were like, you should talk to them. They're used to that and they like it. And so, you know, it was like they said that they have the intelligence of comparable to like a 6 or 7 year old child.
That's amazing.
So they understand, you know, a handful of words. Of course, these elephants really only understood Thai words.
Of course.
But
I was gonna make a joke of it, but yeah, it's implied that they probably don't understand what you're saying.
No, but they have this particular place rescues elephants and takes care of them for life, and they hire people who become like their caretakers, who are kind of. I didn't get a chance to kind of research the origin of these people, but I have the impression that it's almost like an indigenous culture that's, or like a kind of more, maybe indigenous is not quite the right word, but like a rural kind of like a farm community that traditionally made their livelihoods from elephants in some way or another. And so they employ these people along with the rescue of the elephant. I didn't get a chance to get into much about that, but these guys were with us and they were the ones that were clearly practically live with them. I mean, they're really, really comfortable. It was so cool.
They were very friendly. Did they make art?
I didn't see that, but they did. They did understand a few basics of like, you know, like there were a few times where they would walk along. Like this was not a zoo. This was like a rescue. So it was like, we take the elephants on daily walks to make sure they get their exercise. And they said, you basically are invited along while we do that. It wasn't you're gonna
it's,
like
it's not write like they're on,
blah blah blah.
Yeah, it's not like they're on display for you. It's more like you are coming with us. Yeah, we're just living our life. We're just doing our thing. You're just a fly in the wall.
It made it much more pure, I suppose, is the word.
That's cool.
Like it didn't feel like, yeah, they didn't feel like circus performer kind of animals. Yeah. They really felt like we were in their home, and mm-hmm. we were just given the
That's
chance
awesome.
To kind of watch them
I
live their
life.
I
don't think I ever heard anything like that. That's why I just don't like going to zoos.
Oh, it's so depressing.
Yeah, when you told me you were going to meet the elephants, I figured it was going to be something like, you know, they're there waiting for the tourists. So I kind of like raised an eyebrow when you told me that, but I didn't know it was that cool. So
yeah, this place sells, you know, like we bought, you know, an elephant walk package and because they do sell that to tourists as a way to finance taking care of them.
Will you please share their website in order to...
Yeah, I actually asked the woman who was taking us around if I could donate to support them.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I keep meaning to do that. I'm glad you're helping me remember. Their website is www.helpingelephants.org.
Nice.
And they've got social media and stuff on there. Yeah. I haven't checked it out yet, but... They were really lovely people. They were really committed to protecting the elephants and to treating them, you know, keeping them in good health and all that. And it was really cool. It was really
that's awesome.
Really, it was really beautiful to be able to kind of interact with them in that way. So, anyway, a long-winded way of saying I apologize that I was having fun with elephants and missed Brushes and Keys last week, but
yeah,
we are back. I know. You had proposed an excellent idea for our topic.
Yes, I'm actually coming here with kind of like zero research or anything. I was trying to think of like bringing stories or something from artists. But I think I remember actually one of the first conversations we had when we met, when we used to chat, you know, we didn't meet in person, but we used to chat a lot before that. One of the conversations was, I think simple versus simplistic was, and you have very different definitions of each. So let's start from there because I have nothing.
Sure. I mean, this is nothing that the dictionary would necessarily agree with exactly, but it's something I think of just to help my own kind of mental process. Simple versus simplistic. To me, simplistic is a bad thing. Simplistic means you are simplifying not to be more elegant or to be more clear, but out of a belief that the audience is perhaps not smart enough to understand what you're doing. You know, this idea of dumbing down your work or thinking that the audience is somehow, just never going to be able to pay close enough attention, whether you're talking about music or painting or, you know, novelists, screenwriters, poets. Simplistic is an inherently condescending idea in my mind. Mm-hmm. Simple, on the other hand, is sort of the quintessential elegance, is the idea that you have said it in plain but meaningful ways, in plain and meaningful terms, rather. And there's a few different things that feed this idea. First was, I went to school, you know, I studied like formal classical composition training, and the academic environment is full of pretentious composers that write deliberately complicated and sort of confusing music and think that if the audience can follow it in any kind of traditional way, which would be obvious things like a really catchy melody or something, that you've kind of sold out and you've bowed down to the sort of lowest common denominator of that stupid general public, and which is a supremely condescending and cynical point of view to have. And I remember finding myself really resistant to that idea, that this notion that the audience is kind of inherently dumb, and it's therefore a sign of quality that you've confused them or that they are left emotionally cold to your work. So that was one thing that started to lead me to think, you know, simplistic, those folks would say, if you simplify your work, it's because you're making it simplistic. And I found myself thinking about that idea in the context of that environment. And the, I remember once also, I read this book, one of Stephen Hawking's last books. It might be his very last book that he co-authored, and I'm blanking on the name of his co-author, but it was called The Grand Design. And it's basically a book about the nature of the cosmos and the universe. And I remember in the book, they mentioned the idea that scientific theories, and using that term specifically, you know, most people in colloquial language, when they say theory, they mean hypothesis, which basically means, here's my guess about what I think X means or what I think will happen under X conditions, blah, blah, blah. That's a hypothesis. A theory is like the model that you build that explains the facts. So, you know, like the theory of gravity, the theory of evolution by natural selection. These are the scientific models that get worked on and improved and refined, that's tried to really explain the world, explain phenomena that we observe. And in this book, The Grand Design, he talked about how the greatest theories are the simple ones, and how they have this concept of elegance, which you can't really scientifically define, but you kind of know it when you see it. And the ultimate example of this is E equals mc squared, where it's so simple. Energy is mass times the speed of light squared. It's like this equation is so short, so elegant, so simple, and yet huge amounts of research and technology and understandings of the world and of physics can stem from it. And it's like the poster child of power comes from simplicity. And scientific theories, where they go, okay, so here's the model, but if you do it and their velocity is too high, it starts to not work, like Newtonian physics. Or if it gets too hot or too cold, like, you have to account for that, and it doesn't quite work. And you start, once you have all these like little asterisks that say, oh, well, you know, and like into this, right, it's like it loses that elegance. It's not really simple, right, anymore. And it's most scientists will go, this is probably not the final answer. It might work for now and get us one step closer to figuring out the real actual answer later. But there's a certain sense, like, the universe, for whatever reason, no one really knows, has an underlying elegance to its construction. And so most profound discoveries tend to be relatively simple when you truly understand them. Now, I'm way reducing this, but I remember that concept blew me away. I was so, it wasn't the first time I'd necessarily heard it, but there was something about the way they framed it in that book, The Grand Design, that just really struck a chord with me. I found myself thinking about music the whole time, where I thought, you know, Beethoven going bum, 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 bum is as simple as you can get. Mm-hmm. But how powerful. And he gets a whole symphony out of those four notes. And it's not even four notes. It's three notes and then one note. Like, it's so simple, but it's not basic. It's not simplistic. It's not him doing that because he thinks the audience is stupid. It's mm-hmm. him coming up with, you know, this powerful statement.
I think it's the result of him figuring out his craft. Perfection.
You're not wrong about that. I mean, especially in Beethoven's case, who you know, if you listen to music he was writing around and just before the Fifth Symphony, you can hear that na-na-na-na starting to, like, you can hear it kind of hinted at mm-hmm. in other pieces. Mm-hmm. Like, it was in his subconscious, you know? That's common in a lot of artists where there's a major work and the ones before and after have kind of like the dust of the major one. Mm-hmm.
You know, so, yeah. ever since you started talking about other people, I think the best example, and he's not an artist, but he's like a genius. The best example of being simple and elegant, I think, Steve Jobs.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that was the whole MO.
That equals, power.
Yeah, I mean, look at the original iPod of, a little device with a circle and a button and a little screen and saying what can we give people with just that? I agree. There was a certain aspiration to keep things as sort of zen-like as
Exactly.
possible.
It's funny that something like that, the simplicity of their product or the simplicity of a minimalist painting can also be translated as what is the word? Pretentious.
Well, and that's kind of why I like this distinction between simplistic and simple. I know I'm being naive, but it's like, to me, if you see something that strikes you as pretentious and is also seemingly very simple, it's almost, at least in my mind, it's almost like kind of by definition simplistic, because if it feels pretentious, it's probably that they did that to like They did that on purpose, not because the idea was beautifully simple, but to be, accessible or to condescend to the audience for the audience's lack of ability to understand otherwise, or something along those lines. Now I know that that doesn't define everything, because there might be things that
Absolutely.
the
Yeah, no,
artist
they're
truly is trying to just be very simple and elegant, and it still just reads as pretentious to us. That's
right.
certainly possible, and
And
that's just
actually,
taste, I
Apple has
guess.
that fame. They're, people just
I
started.
don't know that pretentious is how I would. I think Apple's biggest problem is that, number one, they, because of the popularity of their products, they do these moves that occasionally upset people, where they'll have like they'll require you to buy their specific charger cable that's not universal, like USB. And so it's like, if I want to charge my iPhone, I need another
Right.
$75 cable or whatever, that kind of thing.
Got it.
Also, there's no overlooking the factory conditions in China and elsewhere,
See,
of
that's the stuff I ignore. So, yeah, I'm not.
yeah, well, it's sort of, in a way, one in a sense has to ignore it in order to kind of truly open-armedly embrace some of these things, because when you d look down the rabbit hole, it can get a little messy,
Right.
but to the point that it can be hard to function in the world. We just have to try to make the world better one brick at a time, because otherwise, every single thing is connected at some end of the chain to something unpleasant or outright awful. And if you make it a point to boycott every product, you'll literally have nothing. And that's not meant as a cynical statement, like the whole world is built on the backs of slave labor or something like that. It's more just that the world is complicated and dynamic, and it's like a giant spider web where everything connects at some point or another to probably something bad. And we as a civilization, I think, are generally trying to make things better. It's my optimistic take on that, but
That's funny that you mentioned the world is complicated by nature. And I remember once I was watching a tech talk from a Thailand guy, like, this is just a normal guy, TEDx. I don't remember exactly what he does or anything. I just remember it was very funny
from
because,
Thailand?
yeah, a Thai
Just by
father,
coincidence, you mean? Like, not
just,
related
yeah,
to the show
completely
or anything?
unrelated, but I remember that his whole point was the world is complicated because we make it that way. Life is actually simple, but we don't see it. There's a lot of people that just don't want to see it. I remember the guy was like, I built houses every, I don't know, a few months, and it's so easy. And I remember he shared pictures of the houses. It's like a very simple, I don't know how to call them, like bungalows type of,
Yeah, right.
right.
Bungalow.
So, yeah,
Like
he's
cabins,
Yeah,
basically.
like cabins. Yeah, so he was like, I don't know why people take months to build their house or even years, and then 30 years to pay them. I built mine in, I don't know, 6 months, and now I have 29 point blah 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 years to live my life, to enjoy it. That was very funny. And his whole point was that, like, here in Thailand, we just work 3 hours, you know, harvest the rice, we do the thing, and that's it. And then the rest of the year, we have festivals. That's why we have so many festivals, because our life is so simple. We don't need to complicate it more. So kind of like his statement was, we are normal. We are so normal that we are abnormal.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think there is often this evangelizing of the idea of, you know, we should return to nature, and that indigenous societies sort of lead an inherently better life in some sense. I pretty thoroughly reject most of those claims, because I think that the net gains of a healthy civilization that is always trying to progress are by far worth it. You know, like modern medicine is an obvious example. The fact that we're recording right now over Zoom, you know, these are things that don't happen unless you kind of get complicated with your life. They don't happen by accident or on their own. People have to work to lay every brick that's in every road and wire every electrical junction that provides house and lighting and heating, and these are all built by people for fellow people.
Right.
And
no, I don't think he meant to, for us to take it literally. Like, we should live like in those bungalows type of houses or anything. But he was making a point of, life can be easy, but we just don't let it. We like to complicate things because we were raised to think that way.
Well, and I agree. I think the spirit of what he means is something I would agree with. And I don't want it to be misconstrued that what I'm saying is that, you know, civilizations that are not so-called first world nations or something, or like indigenous tribes or whatever, are somehow inherently inferior. It's not at all what I'm saying. But I'm saying that there's kind of like a path that humans walk on that maybe moves away from a comparatively simple life, but trades in exchange for that other things that have real material benefit. But he's right that we do well to not forget our roots and not our origins. You know, I remember as a kid growing up in Colorado, we were always exposed. There were a number of Native American tribes that were native to Colorado. And so part of growing up in Colorado is learning about the specific tribes. And in the same way that I'm sure if you grow up in Mexico City, you learn about the Aztecs, like I would imagine. So yeah, growing up in Colorado, you inevitably learn about, like, for example, I remember one of the big tribes of the area was called the Anasazi. And there's, you know, some of these tribes have descendants still living in Colorado. And then other tribes have there's like ruins of their, I'm blanking on the name of it, but there's this one incredible, it's like a mini version of Petra, where this whole kind of city was carved out of the underside of an overhanging cliff. It's shameful that I can't remember the name of it, but it's a classic landmark in Colorado that,
wow,
that we visited, and that probably every school kid.
Well, here, I'll just look it up because I'm curious.
I think it's Mesa Verde.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Look up Mesa Verde. It's a whole kind of civilization that was carved into the underside of this kind of like cliff. And, you know, we went and visited it, and
oh, that's cool.
It's very impressive. And I wish I could remember the specifics of
that's
the history.
That's so funny, because it looks like a miniature. It looks like sandcastles.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and you know, I think it's been a long time since anybody actually lived there and there was an active civilization there.
Wow.
But But I think people lived there for hundreds of years.
Like an ant farm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can see the photos of the people now that I can compare the size of it. That's cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like a town.
Yeah.
And I remember as a kid, really, the kind of spiritual relationship that a lot of these tribes, especially the Open Plains tribes, had to, like, the idea of the hunt. And you're taught as an early kid this idea that when these tribes would hunt big herds of bison and buffalo, there's this classic aphorism of the idea of using the whole buffalo, and that they would, you know, they treat it as almost like entering into a relationship with them, and they make sure to express gratitude to this animal that they've killed, that your life is kind of passing to me, and I don't take that lightly. And, you know, some of this may end up kind of getting romanticized over time, and you know, I'm not a fan of the sort of this concept of the so-called noble savage. It's a very kind of condescending and ahistorical view of, like, these tribes are people the same as all the rest of us, which meant that they had very beautiful practices, and they were also capable of incredible atrocities on one another, and they enslaved each other, and they went to war with each other just like modern civilizations do. So it's not like they were better than any other normal human. I think, to me, the beauty was in the discovery that even these tribes from thousands of years ago, they're actually the same as normal humans. They were actually no different in many regards as us today. And there's something beautiful about that continuity there. But there's no question that certain practices are appreciate the simple things in life, and cultures that really uphold that. I think of an example like Japan, where I studied Aikido when I was in high school, and our sensei, who had studied with the founder of modern Aikido, who's referred to as O-sensei, our sensei had lived with him. He had been his final student before he died. And so he was kind of one of the last links to the creator of modern Aikido. I mean, Aikido is built in forms that go back, you know, God knows how many generations. But he was always sort of evangelizing to us and also the students that he trained for there being, you know, as simple an approach as possible to things. And he also was a chef who had the number one Japanese restaurant in Colorado.
Cool.
Simplicity was again the.
Do they have blowfish?
Probably. It was a really highly rated, and it was also one of those very traditional Japanese where they did not put salt and pepper and soy sauce and things like that on the table for you to add. It was like, I will prepare it for you, as I think it ought to be, and part of our agreement here is, you will accept it how I prepare it, and he, there was a lot that really influenced me. But again, that the value of simple, and also the idea that simple is hard. You know, Aikido, for example, is all about, it's the opposite of karate in many respects. You're not blocking and learning to kind of meet force with force. You're learning to get out of the way and move almost like a ballet dancer. And if someone throws a punch, it's about letting them fall forward because their punch doesn't connect with anything. You're just like float out of their way. And there's something about when you watch someone who's really good at it, it feels like they're hardly working. They're hardly moving. And that, to me, that's a perfect demonstration of that simple. The reason why simplistic is bad is because you're taking a thing that is maybe naturally complicated and trying to dumb it down. Whereas simple, it's like something that sort of springs up out of the earth in a way, in using only exactly what's needed and nothing more.
Right.
And that there's something to aspire to that. I remember with Sonia, with regard to painting, for example, in your corner of these things, I remember once she would make these paintings that were, it's hard to call them simple because they were so colorful. And there was so much texture and movement and they were like these dances, you know, there were so many layers. It was one, the more you studied it, the more you realized it, she would put down coat after coat after coat, and you could really feel this depth. And then one time she just stopped and just made these paintings that were almost pure white, where she would be painting white paint on the white canvas and then add the softest blue and then paint white over that. So you catch, like, it's almost like shadow below the white. Mm-hmm. And by the end, they were just barely not white. But when you study them closely, you realize there's a whole universe there of texture. and it was at a glance, it thought, what could be simpler than a white painting?
It wasn't, though.
It wasn't there's at all. She mm-hmm. agonized over them. And they to me, they were emotional. They actually were really... It was like they felt like they taught me about life. It was profound to watch her make them. And then she did, I think, three of them and then moved on and tried new things and never really did that again that I remember.
Oh, wow.
That it taught me a lot that simple, what makes simple powerful is actually that it's so difficult to achieve, whether it's martial arts or cooking. Or,
and actually, I have a quote right here. Simple can be harder than complex. You have to work hard to get your thinking clean to make it simple. But it's worth it in the end, because once you get there, you can move mountains. That was Steve Jobs.
Yeah, 100% accurate. It is.
It is hard. It is hard to know where to stop. It is hard to know how to manage the visual economy, how to like get to the point without noise around it.
It's true. I think artists, it's usually the mark of a young artist, whether it's a painter or a composer or whatever, that their work is very complicated. There tends to be the trajectory of when they're young and kind of a little bit arrogant and a little bit energetic and all that. As my mother would say, when they're young and full of piss and vinegar, it's easy to overwrite or to overcomplicate your work, because it's kind of like, you're trying to show off, or you're trying to prove to the world how good your technique is. Mm-hmm. And composers are certainly guilty of this. And I am certainly very guilty of this.
Yeah, we learn from it. We pass through that because we, obviously as humans, we tend to make mistakes and we learn from that. Once we know what we did in the past, we can know it when somebody else is doing it.
Oh, for sure.
We can spot that.
Absolutely. Yeah, which is, you know, that opens up a whole other discussion about just kind of the notion of innocence versus experience and why certain people start to become actually jaded and cynical. But I think that's a separate offshoot of the point you're making. Mm-hmm. It's related, but not quite. I get mm-hmm. what you're saying. I think it can be difficult. You know, it's a weird contradiction, because on the one hand, yes, young creators tend to overcomplicate their work out of a desire to prove things, but there also are sometimes young creators that their inherent innocence makes them create things that are simple and great, and then the more experience they get, the more they actually cloud that, because now they've learned a lot, they have new things they want to try. And you know, I definitely know that. I remember my parents always used to tell me that Spirit of the Cosmos was their favorite thing I ever did. It drove me crazy because I looked at it and I said, you know, this is not good though, because it's so
here,
simple.
Here is a little note. Spirit of the Cosmos is like Austin's first album ever. And he just hates it because artists, you know.
Well, but I was a teenager. All that music was written between the age of 16 and 18. And so I look back at it. Now, never mind that I just blatantly rip off, you know, like it's full of very derivative things, because I was mostly kind of self-taught I had some help. I had some wonderful teachers, but the nuts and I didn't have formal composition training by any stretch until I got to college. So you learn the way a lot of artists learn, where you see a thing you like and you say, I wonder if I can figure out how they made that by trying to make it myself.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And some,
which is great. Which is
great.
Yeah,
I mean, Bach copied Vivaldi. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. everybody has done this. The good artists are the ones that then become very dissatisfied with that and try to do their own thing, and the weak artists are the ones that never stop duplicating other people's work. In fact, you could arguably say they're not actually artists. They're more like technicians or you know, like I don't even know what a term would be, but. But to me, there's a certain curiosity implicit in the term artist that if you're just copying other people, it seems like you're kind of inherently
curious. I think as an artist, you have to do it all. Yes, it's okay to study others' paintings. It's okay to make a copy of them, of those paintings, in order to understand what was the process, or, you know, just mm-hmm. just to learn. But you have to move on. You have to find yourself. And I think actually, now that I say that, that you were talking about martial arts, that is, I think, not that I'm an expert, but I know that is a basic, like a rule that the Shaolin masters have, you know, like the whole point is not about fighting, it's about finding yourself. It's like a journey to self-discovery, all that. And it's all around simplicity. You see them with their, you know, like the yellow costumes, and that's all they own.
Yeah, it's the same like with the Buddhist monks that I had the good luck to interact with as part of this Thai cave project. You know, it's a life built around trying to declutter your mind. You know, a lot of Buddhism centers around letting go of all attachments to everything.
Yeah.
What is the maximally simple life? It is one which is devoid of all the complications that come from attaching to material objects, and even attaching to, you know, your own mortality in a way, you know, and just trying to let go of trying to control everything. And
yes,
I'm certainly no Buddhist, and if any Buddhists listening are bothered by my overly reductive description of the belief system, I admit I'm no expert, but I occasionally read things, and I've certainly read Buddhism influenced things before, and I have friends who are mm-hmm. Buddhists who talk about particularly the idea of letting go. And another thought that came to mind when you were talking about that TEDx speaker from Thailand that I realized I didn't mention was that classic sort of flow chart where it says, you know, do you have a problem? And then there's
the
branch that comes out that says,
yes.
Can you do something about it? If yes, you go to the right. If no, you go to the left. But they both reconverge on the then don't mm-hmm. worry about it.
Don't worry.
And mm-hmm. I thought that is a beautifully simple mm-hmm. way of explaining why most of the time when we have these complicated dramas in our life where we're worried about, oh, this person said this, or the politics of this situation, la 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 la.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sonia, again, was another very powerful influence on my life at recognizing that in those situations, you can kind of most of the time step back and go, you know, I'm actually letting the complexity of this rule over me, and I don't need to. It's actually mm-hmm. probably most situations are simpler than we make them out to be.
You tend to tell me that. Life is not that simple, and I actually most of the time disagree. I think it can be very simple. It's as simple as just let it go. Just don't talk to this person anymore, or don't go there, or just, you know, keep doing your job, whatever.
I can definitely give you credit as being a valued partner in reminding me on a not infrequent basis to practice what I preach in this way. I that is one of my weaknesses, that I sometimes kind of
improving. Austin used to talk on social media more. I know that you actually were worried.
I got into arguments with people all the time.
Of course, but because you care about them. But there's no point
in
arguing.
I care about them, and I also care about truth. If I see people being wrong about something that I feel like I might know something about, the problem is, I don't enter into those conversations with the belief I know I'm right and I'm here to correct you. It's more like, I think I have information you might not have, and I'd like to share it in the belief that you will see a wider view. And maybe you'll teach me in the process. That's the most, that's the most positive spin. Sometimes it's not quite
I think you're very naive that everybody is going to answer positively to that way of thinking, because as my own experience, I've lost friends being like that. So from now on, since I had a little thing in the past, I just let them, you know, if they want to argue let them do it. I don't have anything to do here. If they want to talk to me, I'll be open, but not in social media. It's just the worst place to.
Well, that's exactly it. I don't think I'm naive about humanity's general willingness to learn new things and be proven wrong, but social media has definitely proven that.
Yeah, you're naive that you can do that through social media.
Well, not anymore. That's why I don't do it anymore. Right. I realize most people, they will project the tone, they will project an arbitrary tone on what you're saying.
Exactly.
Based on whatever's going on in their life.
Exactly.
And derail, the whole conversation can derail. And we're, and I say they as if we're not capable of this problem ourselves. We all can misread people.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I'm not a fan at all of like this kind of, you know, kind of like a meme. I don't mean in the sense of like an image with text, but in the actual Richard Dawkins sense of the word, but like a unit of information. There's sort of a recurring phrase that people use where they'll say, you know, I believe X and no one can convince me otherwise or whatever. Like you see people tweet that, you know, like Black Panther's the best MCU movie and nothing will convince me otherwise. And most of the time people say it kind of as a joke and it's all well and good. But I actually kind of turns my stomach even as a joke because I go, you don't want to live your life where you're like, no facts could ever dissuade me from this position. There's no position we should ever hold that would define. I mean, no matter how, even the most ardent religious believers will acknowledge there's value in having doubts. And even if it leads you to reaffirm your faith later, this is obviously not my path, but I appreciate like when I hear a pastor talk about how they went through a crisis of faith and it ultimately helped strengthen their faith. The only way they got there was because they listened to those doubts and it led them to some path of discovery, even though I personally came to a very different conclusion as a unapologetic atheist. I respect very much somebody that says, what if I'm wrong? What if everything I've been taught is wrong? I should really listen and I should really explore and learn and be open. One of the, there's a guy, I don't really follow him anymore, but there's a guy who I followed for a while on YouTube named Matt Dillahunty, who was a popular host on a TV show, you could call it, called The Atheist Experience, where he grew up in a deeply religious environment. But he was always a very smart guy. And so he just believed because he grew up in it and he never really questioned it. And then he had this roommate who was an atheist and it broke his heart because he thought, he's going to go to hell. And this guy's like a brother to me. I don't want him to go to hell. So he decided it's my mission in life to convert him to my particular Southern Baptist Protestant beliefs. So he started doing a lot of research on atheism to learn the arguments so he could understand his roommate's position better and then learn the response to those arguments from a Christian perspective as a way to begin the process of converting. And because he was genuinely open-minded, he actually ended up causing his own deconversion. He ended up, his attempt to learn more about the atheist worldview aimed at converting his atheist roommate resulted in him turning himself into an atheist, which I always love that story, not because it's like one plus one for my team. Again, it's not about that. People should believe whatever they believe, whatever has convinced them of the truth or whatever their heart tells them. But remain open. Always remain open. And don't automatically believe what you're told. I know that we're kind of a little bit off the rails here from the notion of simplicity.
I know.
Forgive me.
Yes.
But they connect to that because
a little.
I can tell you.
I do think some people they're just trolls about, you know, the Marvel movie or whatever. That's just because they just want to.
Yeah, they're joking. They're being silly, and they're trying to be provocative. I don't mean to be overly serious. Like, there's not room for people to be silly. Of course, I don't care. It's just the sentiment of nothing can convince me.
Right.
It's like, well, you just don't know.
What can I could convince you of eating sour cream?
I have. I don't like it. It's nasty. The only time I've ever liked it is when there's a tiny little drop that's put on top of tortilla soup, and then you stir it and you mix it with the soup.
And it's completely gone.
No, but it adds something that's actually nice. It changes the flavor. There's this great science writer named Julia Galef, who I just love. And I don't know if science writer is the right way to describe her, but she had a great YouTube channel and managed to turn her ideas into a book called The Scout Mindset. And she quotes from this essay in there where she says the author talks about, if you want to be the most open to the world, keep your identity small. And that, to me, very much connects to this Buddhist notion of a simple life devoid of as many attachments as you can manage. Because then what happens is when someone challenges your belief, it doesn't challenge who you are, because who you are is actually a very tiny set of things. Like if someone were to show to me that drinking coffee is fundamentally immoral, you know, like let's just use like a real world example of like veganism. So if somebody were to really lay out, and I've listened to those arguments, and I find myself over time kind of like losing my resistance to those arguments, and because a lot of them boil down to there is no moral stance on which to rest eating meat or even eating dairy. You just have to admit you do it because you like it, and you're willing to accept the suffering of an animal. And I'm like, I guess I am willing to accept the suffering of an animal, but I am increasingly uncomfortable with that fact. Every day that goes by, it's hard for me to imagine myself becoming vegan, but I also can't deny the arguments are pretty solid. There's a few health-related arguments about sources of animal protein and things like that, that like our bodies are definitely not built to be vegan.
But they're also not built to not be.
It's like we're omnivores. We can survive on quite a wide variety. It's one of the kind of remarkable things about human evolution. The point of which being that let's say somebody convinces me that veganism truly is the way to go. The core of who I am, my identity, is not wrapped in with the idea of eating meat. It doesn't. So in other words, it doesn't pose this existential threat to my psyche to change belief there. But if your whole world is like, oh, I'm a barbecue chef and I'm like, that's my whole thing, then that would actually be like a crisis of identity to suddenly be faced with very persuasive arguments about veganism. So the simpler our identity, the fewer things that truly define who we are, the more open we are to learning and growing. And that was something that was highlighted in this book of Julia Galef's that I thought was, so much of our political problem in the world today is that someone goes, it's not that I am persuaded by progressive arguments from the left or conservative arguments of the right. It's that my soul, I am a progressive. I am a conservative. And the problem is you then become unpersuadable because now it's your identity at stake. It's your very soul. And I think that's an unhealthy way to be. I think that if you listen to arguments, you can reach maybe the same conclusions. But if then something comes along later that says, you know, maybe consider this perspective. It's not tugging at the threads of your very being to do that. And I think that connects. I don't think it's a stretch to say that that's like making who we are as simple as possible.
No.
Makes us open to the world. A sense of tiny personal identity is, I think, a very profound insight that is worth trying to model. Like that, let go of attachments to those.
Wow, you got deeper than I was suspecting. I was just gonna talk about art, but okay.
Art is a reflection of life, isn't it? So that's, yeah. Anyway, that's a little bit of my... I liked when you proposed this. I thought, ooh, this is definitely a topic I think a lot about.
I can tell you. We're very excited.
And I try to be simple. You know, it's one of those that... It's not lost on me that... I really do. I mean it in all sincerity, especially with my music. I listen to... Sometimes it does feel like the right choice to get a bit complicated. And you listen to music from Banner Saga, Assassin's Creed... even parts of Abzu, Aliens, Fireteam. Like, there are moments in those scores that are pretty complex because it did seem they needed to be. But it's not lost on me that, like, you go on Spotify, my most streamed track by far is among the simplest things I ever wrote, which is Nascence from Journey. And, like, I don't look at that and I go, ugh, I hate that the thing I wrote in an hour, not even an hour, the thing I wrote in 5 minutes is the most popular. It's actually, like, I look at it and I go, I should never forget that I had a clarity of mind and I managed to, I got lucky and found something simple. And there was apparently something meaningful in that simplicity and that that's always the thing to that's aspire to.
It's a perfect example of less is more.
Isn't it
your recent track Innocence called Simplicity? Was it Simplicity?
Life Could Be Simple was, I remember the little tagline they put with title. Flo. Mm-hmm. Loved that.
So nice. It's one of my favorites.
That whole project was a study in the question of how simple can you get and still feel like you're kind of being elegant and not simplistic.
Exactly. Mm-hmm,
And it was so fun to return to that for this Traveler Symphony project, to return to the flow music particularly that is as simple as anything, probably the most simple of anything I've ever written, and still seemingly has a kind of popularity to it all these years later. And as tiny and as niche as a game of as flow was, it was a nice reminder conducting that in London to how simple it was to go, this really is worth aspiring to each time. You don't graduate past that. You should try to sort of keep things simple. Different circumstances call for it in different ways, but I literally just today got a boatload of feedback on a new project the note was all this needs to be simpler. Just another reminder.
I guess you get that a lot, right? You kind of like you like to decorate a little bit more than they like it.
It depends. I've gotten that feedback before. And it really depends on the circumstances. Because sometimes I'm hired explicitly because people say, you know, we want this to feel, you know, unpredictable and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that theoretically could mean complicated or whatever. But
right.
Like nobody ever complained in the case of, for example, Fireteam. There can be a lot of layers happening in there, but that's sort of part of the aesthetic of that.
I still think one of my favorite things that you did in that score was to whisper pie.
Yeah. Well, and you know, pie is a perfect example of something that's sort of simultaneously simple and complicated. You know, there's no end to the digits of pie.
You whisper pie and then you flipped it. Is that correct?
No, it's literally just me whispering.
It's literally the numbers.
Yeah, like the first 20 digits or 30 digits or something.
That's amazing.
In a loop, guys, over and over.
If anyone is playing Aliens Fireteam, I think that is what, like the third mission.
The second campaign.
Second campaign.
Yeah, which is like the. You know, the
robots,
when you start fighting the synths, the sort of the working Joes.
Right.
Yeah, it was just a way to, you know, say, how do we.
Is that the first time you provide your voice?
In that way, I did. There is, you can hear me shouting mixed with Peter Hollins in the funeral sequence from the end of Banner Saga 1.
Oh, wow. I don't think I knew that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kind of, there's like a big funeral, like.
I thought you were going to say Bakram.
No, that's definitely just Peter. but the end of the game has this kind of funeral scene, and the track. I got a lot of the track titles from these Viking proverbs, and so they're these beautifully wonderful kind of phrases, and one of them is, we are all guests upon the land. You know, like our stay here is temporary. We don't own the world, we are guests upon it. And so that was the name I gave to this kind of funeral. In the game, the characters are like singing a funeral song. You could think of it as for one of the characters. So I'm like, yeah, you hear this kind of like shouting. I just had to look it up to remind myself. Mein werder minst is the shouting, which is the line, I will not be forgotten. So I had Peter shout it, and I had, I'm suddenly forgetting his name also, Johan Sigurdsson, our amazing voice actor who sang a little bit for me, who lives in Iceland.
Nice.
And I never met him in person, but he recorded for me the Godstone songs and this funeral bit, and then Peter, of course. Where you hear all the, it's like the idea of like they're singing this do yo do, and then the background this mean verum minst of like, I will not be forgotten. That I fucking love working on that game so much. I just love they captured a world so well. Because I remember the way Arnie and Alex described it in the early days of, it's not about saving the world, it's about looking at death with courage. And I just thought, what a great idea to start from. And you haven't failed if you die. You succeed by your inevitable death being one that you embrace with dignity and courage. I remember there was a headline even, Polygon or somebody said something like the Banner Saga taught me how to die or something like
that.
Something along those lines. Or I remember it felt like, if I remember the article correctly, it seemed like they really got the idea of what we were going for. Anyway.
Amazing.
So to that end, my album of the day pick was...
Oh, thank you. Finally, like the second time Austin gives us a album of the day.
Well, so I don't mean for this podcast to kind of be a soundtrack album podcast, but there was a...
You said that the first time, but bring it.
What was the... What did I say? Which album was it then? I don't even remember now.
Doom.
yeah, of course.
Austin, you're failing so miserable on your promises.
Yeah, well, this is why it's a good partnership, because I know that you'll you'll bring up very different albums. But... I had to choose the 1966 Jerry Goldsmith score, A Patch of Blue, which was one of the very first scores of his I ever heard when I was about 10 years old, and it made me fall in love with both his music and the idea of being a composer. But the reason I specifically choose it in the context of a discussion of simplicity and the merit and how good and laudable it is to be simple and to aspire to simplicity was because I remember I discovered these other scores of his from around that time, like Planet of the Apes, which is some of the most vicious and complex music you can imagine. I mean, the hunt sequence from the original Planet of the Apes is, I think, one of the great cues in the whole history of cinema. But anybody that calls it simple is just wrong. It is complicated in the best way. It is one that it needs to be complicated. The orchestra is like this... you know, like Howl's Moving Castle giant machine with a lot of parts that are all working together, and it's absolutely an incredible feat. And the fact that
I love that comparison,
well, because you know, it's like it's all moving as one, but yet it's a lot to digest.
It's perfect.
So within 1 year ish of him writing that score, he writes this score to A Patch of Blue, which is this poignant drama about a blind girl living in the kind of Jim Crow segregated South who develops this beautiful relationship with Sidney Poitier, unaware that she, a white girl, is developing this dynamic with a black guy, older black guy, which is forbidden. You know, this is a taboo thing, but she's blind. She's literally blind. And there's a real Jerry Goldsmith in this score. It's built around this kind of almost lullaby on piano, doing this da-da-da-dum, ba-da-da-dum, and then the melody comes in. It's as simple as anything could be, and it just rips your guts out.
What year is this?
I think 66, if memory serves.
Okay, because it sounded much like Home Alone.
na 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 na, slightly higher upper pitch. Yeah, this one.
I guess I have to listen first before hearing you, because you're not very accurate anyway.
I'll give you my trick that I used during our Stray Gods recording sessions. So one goes.
That's Home Alone. Uh-huh.
Versus Goldsmith.
Okay, yeah, so it was your performance that was...
As always.
Incorrect. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, very different.
Yeah, but
it does so sound like simple. A lullaby that we all know, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I remember John Debney once telling me that it was based... He had discovered that score was based on a French... French lullaby that Jerry had kind of found a clever way to use. I've never actually investigated that and found the song that he's referring to, or he may have been wrong, or I'm remembering wrong what he said, but it does kind of sound like it though, with this ba-da-da-dum, mm-hmm. You know, very, very simple, absolutely very beautiful. Nice. This, mm-hmm. Let's see if I can.
I'm actually offended that you're playing on your phone, having your piano.
It's too far to reach. Yeah, it's to me that score for little 10-year-old me to hear these complicated scores, or like Patton.
Oh, yeah, difference.
So really, and then to see the same artist within a 12 or 18 month period write something so elegant and simple made me realize that a true artist's capacity should be for the full range of possibilities. It's okay if not every piece of music is simple or every piece of music complicated, but you should, there's, at least I found very appealing, mm-hmm. this continuous exploring of how simple can I get here and how wild and crazy can I get over here, and like this pendulum that swings.
As we said before, we as artists have to test everything we can in order to just grow and discover what we like and who we are.
Yeah, 65. I just looked it up because that felt, I felt like I was wrong.
1965. Yeah.
Yeah, 1965, Patch of Blue. A blind, uneducated white girl is befriended by a black man who becomes determined to help her escape her impoverished and abusive home life by introducing her to the outside world.
Oh, wow. That's fun. And, it's like a princess story.
And Jerry's score is just as beautiful and delicate as they come. And he wrote a lot of scores like that. But he was certainly most famous for big action and drama and experimental, weird, like Alien But this one always held a very special place in my heart. And so I found myself going in circles trying to think of, like, what's a really good example of something
that's a great
simple
suggestion.
And that was the one I landed on.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much, Austin, for your...
Service,
yes.
Well, thank you. I guess that's all I've got.
Yeah, I didn't even get to talk about art, but... Whatever, you know, I was going to talk about expressionism versus minimalism and all this stuff.
Oh, well.
This is great. Okay. You know, this is, yeah, it's fine. I love listening to you and it's all fun and games.
Well, can we do a separate expressionism versus minimalism
I don't know.
Episode?
I don't wanna
There's
be
great
repetitive.
Musical parallels there. Expressionism was a movement in music, so too was minimalism. They were many decades apart from each other.
Yeah, but maybe we can do the expressionism and then hint a little bit of the minimalism in there.
Whatever you wish.
Thank you so much, Austin, for making time for us mortals.
Oh, come on.
And for sharing your stories, as always. It's so cool. And thank you guys for being here as well. Don't forget that you can find us on social media at Brushes and Keys and send us cute messages.
Yeah, and leave us comments that challenge us on this simple versus simplistic. If someone disagrees with that, I would very much love to hear their case and their
Do you want them to see them fight, huh?
No, not fight with each other. I want to see somebody write a... If someone goes, here's why I think you're wrong. I would love...
You want to see some blood.
I would love to be wrong. No, I love to be wrong. I love to grow and
yeah, I,
and be.
I know. Not many people can take that, so I admire that of you. That's for sure.
Well, as Lawrence Krauss once said, the feeling of realizing you're wrong is actually the feeling of now being right, because you realized you were wrong by learning what the correct answer is. That's the only way you knew you were wrong.
Right.
So it's like, it's actually an exciting feeling to go, oh, I now I know.
Right.
So being wrong is supposed to be good, not supposed to be embarrassing.
True. Very true. Well, don't forget to declutter everything that you don't need. Get into the role of minimalism. I'm actually doing that lately. Very slowly, but I'm on it.
Uh-oh.
Very, very slowly.
Alrighty.
Thank
Bye,
you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. No. Thank you.